Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Good evening, folks, and thank you for being here and joining me this week on Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro. I hope your Valentine's Day week, if you will, is off to a great start. It's an exciting week here on the show. A new hometown sponsor is going to be joining the show next week, a company that I've always dreamed that I would have as part of this show. So I'm very excited to tell you who that's going to be. It will have to wait until next week, but I'm very excited to share with you which sponsor that is going to be. I'm also very excited because tonight I've got 3 rookies joining me as part of the show. It's always great to have first-timers coming to be a part of the show. It's always so fulfilling for me to be able to bring new people onto the show and share their stories and their insights with you. We're going to get a triple dose of it tonight, so looking forward to that. We'll talk about who those folks are going to be in just a moment. We're going to lead off this week's show, of course, like we do every other week, with our Director of Instruction, Tom Patry. This week, TP and I are going to talk about the Wasted Management Open. It's getting completely out of hand over there. I know it's a huge party and it's the People's Open, but it's really gone from being fun to see all the things that happen there to actually starting to get dangerous. It certainly did for one young lady. We'll talk about all of that in just a minute. Plus, the scoring explosion that we're seeing out on the tours. It's like Oprah's show. You can shoot a 59, you get a 59, you get a 57. And we'll also talk about the resurrection of the Maxfly golf ball. So a lot to get into with TP tonight. It's always fun when he's a part of the show. He'll join me here in just a few minutes. Following him, I'm going to be joined by a guy who won twice out on tour, plus the 1984 National Championship, the Western Amateur, and he's become a great college coach as well, and that is John Inman. John is the younger brother of Joe Inman, who you may recognize as well. He had a great playing career out on the PGA Tour. Excited to have John as part of the show. He's going to join me about 25 minutes from now. After him, my second rookie of the week is going to be Barry Cheeseman. Barry won twice out on what was then the Ben Hogan Tour. He was also in the mix several times during the 80s and early 90s. He won the 1986 Florida State Amateur Championship. He's become a fantastic instructor now down in Florida. A lot to get into with him. He'll join me about 45 minutes from now. And then we'll round things out with a visit from Robert Morris head men's golf coach, Steve Shingledecker. Steve is a tremendous athlete, 3-sport athlete at that, played college baseball at NC State. He's coached Franklin High in the Pittsburgh area to a state championship in basketball. He's got a great amateur golf career in that area as well. And like I say, now leading the golf team at Robert Morris. So very much looking forward to having him as part of the show. He'll join me about an hour from now. So I got a great show teed up for you this week, folks. But as always, I can't thank you enough for tuning in and taking the journey with me this week. Before we get started, and like I've been saying to you guys for the last several months, our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, and I have been working with a company called Kickpoint. And they have done some magical things with our logos and created some polo shirts with some wonderful designs where they take our logos and turn them into designs on a polo shirt. They're absolutely outstanding. Kickpoint Golf is a private label custom golf apparel company making bespoke polo shirts, quarter zips, and hoodies for those selected clubs looking to take their branded game to a whole new level. If you want to check out their apparel, and again, it's going to knock your socks off, send an email to info@kickpointgolf.com. They'll get right back to you. There's no middleman. They're going to go right to the guys that do this work. You're going to check it out, and you are really going to love what they do. I'm going to start showing the polo shirts that they designed for me on my Instagram, @CTMascaro. Check them out there. so you can get a sample of what they look like. These guys know where it's at. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddy's trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen, Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You gotta see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade. From the very beginning, P790 irons have been rooted in clean aesthetics and thoughtful design. However, their true beauty is found beneath the surface. With AI-optimized weighting and speed foam air on the inside, every iron is uniquely designed to perform exactly how you need it to. As striking as they are on the outside, their true beauty lies within. Learn more about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade by checking out their website at TaylorMadeGolf.com. All right, now back with us is our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry. As you know, TP is the director of player development at the Twin Eagles Club in Naples, Florida. He is a 13-time Golf Magazine Top 100 teacher, a 4-time PGA Teacher of the Year, 3-time Golf Digest Best in the State, including in their most recent December 2023, January 2024 edition. And he is back for an amazing 93rd time with me here on Next on the Tee. Good evening, TP. How are you, my friend?
T-boy!
What's up, Tommy boy? How are you?
Chris, I just had an unbelievable evening. About 3 nights ago, Denise made her famous homemade lasagna.
Ooh.
Which is, it's pretty strong, okay? That's okay. But there's nothing better to me than leftover.
Day two?
Yeah,
lasagna.
Yeah, day two lasagna, and we had. I kind of scoured it down tonight. You know, a couple two large pieces tonight, and then followed it up with her chocolate coconut cake.
Get out!
Oh, I'm telling you, what a night, man! What a night! You know,
when you
get to my age, those are the things that excite you.
Let's about out another loop.
It's been a hell of a night, man. Hell of a night. Now I got you. So how
did you get me?
It's unbelievable. Great night.
All right, so let's get right into it, because we are on the heels of this year's Waste Management Open. Perhaps a better name next year should be the Wasted Management Open, because this event, Tom, is just getting out of hand. At one point, they had to close the gate, shut down the liquor sales because the crowd was getting out of control. We had people body surfing down hills by the stands on 18. One guy got arrested for making a sand angel in one of the bunkers. There was a streaker on Sunday. They're heckling Zach Johnson out there, which threw him over the edge. Billy Horschel had to get involved and start calling people out. Jordan Spieth pointed out someone in the crowd after he hit his approach shot on 18 that guy yelled in his backswing. He immediately drops his club. I mean, I know the tour sort of signed up for this thing, Tom, when they condoned what goes on there at 16 and they built the stadium hole, but it was a bit cringeworthy this year, and I thought it got out of control. What are your thoughts?
Well, you forgot to mention the lady that fell out of the stands and got hurt, too.
Right.
Yeah, so you forgot that one. So let's add her in there, too. Hope she's okay. Yeah, it's really simple. Be careful what you wish for. You may get it. Well, they wished for it, and they got it, right? And now it is totally out of control. I mean, listen, I get the stadium hole. I get the par three. I get the yelling and the screaming. It's fun. But when you put a couple hundred thousand people on property and you just pour the alcohol down their throats, something eventually is going to happen. Guess what? It happened in droves this year. And now you got to go back and rethink this whole thing, because maybe that model isn't such a good idea in 2024. It was way over the top, way over the top.
Yeah, and I mean, I get that alcohol plays a big role, and because of weather, we had to push, you know, they had to play 30-something holes, you know, one day to kind of catch up and get things going and all that sort of thing. So people had extra time to get all liquored up. But as you allude to, Tom, 2024 is a meaner, nasty place. We see it every day out on social media.
Yep.
While heckling guys. And Billy Horschel talked about, you know, hey, people need to have a little respect. On some level, there are still guys out here trying to win a golf tournament. And one of the fans yelled at him, well, you knew what you were signing up for when you came and played this event. And I don't know that you do. I mean, I know that you expect to get in there on 16. And if you don't make it onto the green, or you hit a bad shot, or you miss a putt, people are going to boo you. That's sort of the charm of the thing. I get it. But you're really not signing up for people heckling you, yelling in your backswing, and all that sort of stuff. I agree with you. I think at some point now, and I think we've reached that point, Jay Monahan and the tour officials got to take a look at what we got going on here and understand this is a different day and time. And if you give people a lot of time to get liquored up, you're going to end up with a situation just like this. You got to make some change.
It's too much. I mean, you know, again, you have that many people drinking on the same property in close quarters, and you're going to get a percentage of knuckleheads out there that just, you know, don't know when enough's enough. And, you know, the heckling and all that kind of stuff, that's one thing. But when people start falling out of stands and hurting themselves, you know, you have a liability issue, and it can really come back to bite you. It wouldn't take much to really make that a really ugly scene. You know, I just think it's way over the top. Just enough's enough.
Tom, speaking of other things that have gotten out of hand, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen players out on the Korn Ferry Tour shoot 57 and 59. We've seen Joaquin Neiman out on the LIV Tour shoot 59. And oh, by the way, one of the kids that shot a 59 on the Korn Ferry Tour was 19, by the way. We've seen a couple of 60s out on the PGA Tour, highlighted by Wyndham Clark going out and shooting a course record 60 at Pebble Beach. It's like the Oprah show, Tom. You get a 59, and you get a 59, and you get a 57. I mean, it's getting crazy out there.
Yeah, you know, way back when, we talked about this off air today, Chris, you know, Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile after science told us that the male could never run a sub 4-minute mile. And the whole world believed that, except for Roger Bannister. So once Roger Bannister broke that 4-minute mile, you know, in the next ensuing weeks, several other guys broke it as well. The proverbial mental wall was down. So I think we've seen that happen in a couple of fronts in golf. You know, when I was playing, and I'm going back a long time, I know, but if a guy hit it 300 yards, it was unprecedented. And then another guy did it, and all of a sudden, you know, the lid's off, and here we go with distance. And now, from a scoring standpoint, you know, breaking 60 was unheard of. I mean, back when I played, nobody even thought about breaking 60. And now you have guys doing it left and right because they believe they can do it. There is a mental roadblock in some of these achievements that once it's down, all bets are off. I think on the other side, though, Chris, in the Pebble situation, you got to remember that was a little bit of a rarefied air, because what Wyndham did there that day, I think he bested the field by over 5 shots that day. So there was nobody even close to him. He was you know, more or less an outlier in that case on a very, very soft defenseless golf course. And he got it going. And when you have that many talented people in one location, somebody's going to get hot and run the table. The other situation on the Korn Ferry Tour in South America, you and I talked about this off air. You know, when I saw all those scores coming in, not only the 57, but so many, you know, low 60 scores, you know, I popped it online because I didn't know anything about the site. And they were playing on 2 golf courses. One was 6,200 yards, and one was 7,200 yards at 8,000 feet. So effectively, the 6,200-yard golf course was, you know, 5,800 or 5,900 yards, and the 7,200 golf course was, you know, 69 and change. And you know, as far as these guys hit it today, can you imagine putting a PGA Tour event on the 6,200? Who made that decision to put it on a 6,200-yard golf course at 8,000 feet? I mean, come on. That means, you know, even an old dog like me could go out and shoot a number on that golf course.
So that does bring up what the other question I wanted to ask you is, it's not like the course snuck up on them and they just realized one day when they got there that it was, oh, it's 8,000 feet up here. You know, I mean, holy cow, this golf course is going to play too easy. I mean, you know, years in advance where courses are going to be, you know, what courses you're going to play, what the schedule looks like and what the course conditions are going to be. To me, that to your point, how do you end up allowing a professional event, particularly at the Korn Ferry Tour level, to be played at that short a distance?
Chris, I don't have an answer for you. I mean, I was kind of when I popped on the course stats and the, you know, the course layout and everything, I kind of did a double take. I mean, the LPGA Tour plays golf courses significantly longer than that golf course at just the length, and then at 8,000 feet of elevation. You know, for anybody who's played golf in Denver, it's different. I remember playing in the Mexican Open in 1982, I believe, in Mexico City. And I remember playing the first hole or the second hole, and the scorecard was like 460 yards, 470 yards, par four, back in 1982, which we didn't see those things in those days. And I was like, holy crap, this is long. I hit the drive out there and had like an 8-iron, 9-iron. What happened? Is the scorecard wrong? No, dummy. You're a mile above sea level. This thing goes a long way. And, you know, to play a golf course in 2024 in a professional event with very skilled young players at 6,200 yards, 8,000 feet, I'd like to know who made that decision. It seems a little odd to me.
Speaking of going a long way and something that's odd to me, I saw the news a couple of weeks ago that Lexi Thompson switched golf balls. She's now going to play a Maxfly, Tom. I haven't heard a tour player on any tour playing Maxflies since the 80s. Are you surprised to hear that Lexi made the switch to Maxfly?
Maybe she's having trouble paying her mortgage or something, Chris, and she needed a little extra.
You think
cash.
Maybe she?
She needed a little extra cash. No, I mean. You know, Lexi puzzles me on a lot of fronts, and some of the things she's done and decides to do, and some of the behaviors. But I don't know of any person I know that's a professional college player, ranked amateur, club champion at a recreational. I don't know where to buy a Max Fly, Chris. You know, other than maybe Dick's Sporting Goods or something like that. And I'm not knocking Dick's at all. Don't get me wrong. But I haven't seen a Maxfly golf ball. I don't know when the last time I saw one was, to tell you the truth. So I don't know what's that. I don't know what that's about. I hope it's worth a lot to her as far as her pocketbook. Because I don't care. You know, and you know me, I'm a Titleist loyalist, you know, through and through. You know, you're playing competitive golf for a living. Your equipment is really important, and the golf ball is a very important piece of equipment. Lexi, not a great choice.
So let's talk about golf balls for a moment, because we talk about getting fit for our golf clubs all the time and how important that is. And it's even more important for amateurs like me, weekend warriors. You know, some of my buddies always talk about how that's for professional guys. That's not for guys like us. And it's actually the opposite. It's more for guys like us than it is for professionals. But a lost piece in that is getting fit for your golf ball, because you could have the greatest woods and irons on the planet. But if you're hitting the wrong golf ball, you're really cheating yourself. Talk about the importance of finding the right ball for your swing.
It's funny you should ask me that question. And we did not talk about this before. And I didn't know you were going to ask me that question. But just by coincidence, say at the beautiful Twin Eagles Club in Naples, Florida, we had a Titleist golf ball fitting deck. And we had Titleist representative in to anybody who wanted to come by and talk to them about the importance of the golf ball, and based on swing speed and different skill sets, you know, what was the best ball for the player. And Titleist was kind enough to provide free samples to everybody who wanted to attend or stop by the booth on the range. Yeah, the golf ball is very important. I mean, you know, it's amazing to me that in 1981, when I won that NCAA, that I played a Balata ball in a wooden headed club. I recently took that driver out and hit it on the range with some modern balls. And first of all, the size of the club was scary to me. I don't know how I hit it back then. don't really know how to hit that golf club. But the golf ball and the Balata golf ball compared to the Pro V1 today or any quality golf ball today was like a marshmallow back then. We thought, and it was the greatest thing. We had nothing to compare it to, so we thought it was the greatest thing on the planet. The golf ball technology across all skill sets has come so far in the last, I'm going to call it 25 years. And even from year to year has come so far that if you're not really paying attention to that, you're right, Chris, you are cheating yourself. There are horses for courses and there are golf balls for players. The golf ball is very important. And to educate yourself, maybe go online, do a little reading, understand your swing speed and understand maybe your launch angle with the driver and go get fit for a golf ball. I think it's very important. Very, very important.
Tom, you're Mr. Short Game, Short Game, Short Game. And one of the ways for weekend warriors like me to do the things that we want to do from a goal perspective at the beginning of a golf season, whether your goal is to break 100, break 90, or break 80, one of the ways to do that for us is in our short game. Bobby Jones always talked about the key is to turn three into two. Talk about some of the things that weekend warriors like me can do. And I know we got to practice and all of that sort of thing because we all want to hit the ball further when people spend way too much time on their driver and not enough time on their wedge game. But talk about a way for us to turn three into two.
Well, I mean, I think the magic word you used, first of all, Chris, and foremost, was practice. And then understanding your equipment. And you know, when Bob Vokey came along and really, I think, really, really, truly revolutionized the design of the wedge and went to different grinds and different bounces and different lofts. I mean, I think about it all the time. When I was playing competitively during most of my career, both as a collegiate player and then as a professional, the highest lofted club, lofted wedge you could buy on the planet was 55 degrees. And the wedge, the configuration of bounce back then compared to what we have today was so incredibly crude. You know, guys like Bob Vokey changed that forever. And understanding how to use a wedge and use the bounce against the ground and hit different shots now, you know, with a little help from a coach, could really change your ability to take three into two, as Mr. Jones said. You know, bunker play, I mean, at the recreational level, one of the things I see everywhere I've taught in my career is, and I've been at some great places, Chris, as you know, that have great practice facilities. Westchester was wonderful. Friarshead was off the charts. And Twin Eagles might be the best practice facility in Southwest Florida. We have a practice bunker. We have a practice short game area. We have undulations and nooks and crannies to hit different shots from different lies. And so many clubs are starting to have really good short game areas and paying more attention to that. And it would behoove every amateur out there who's listening to this broadcast to grab a competent teacher and spend, I'm going to call it 70% of their time in their next golf season working from 30 yards and in. It would change their life. It would change their enjoyment of the game. It would change that little box at the end called total on the scorecard. There's a lot of different ways to hit a lot of different shots, and it's not always a 101 thing. You know, if you can get your skill set to a 301 level, that total box is going to have a very different number in it.
Tom, something else that you've talked about recently on your Instagram page and something that we see tour players like Justin Thomas do, and that's a backswing rehearsal that goes to about hip high. Talk about takeaway cue and getting the club started properly in our backswing.
Yeah, as our old friend, the great Bob Grissett, you know, taught me, you know, P1, position one is addressed, and P2 is when the club gets waist high. And depending on what you're trying to do with your golf ball in terms of which kind of shape or trajectory you're trying to hit, at P2, that club face could be in a number of different positions, depending, again, on what you're trying to do. Certainly, you know, one of the things I see coming out of the starting gate with so many amateurs is a broken sequence. And what I mean by that, Chris, is that, you know, I like to see the golf club, the arms, and the torso come out of that starting gate in a dead heat. There was a really good player back a ways back. You might have heard of him. His name was Jack Nicklaus. And he talked about a thing called the one-piece takeaway. And he basically was just trying to get everything moving in a dead heat that nobody kind of won the race. There was no rabbit and there was no hare. Everybody came out of there in dead heat. And the basic premise, old school premise was, boy, if everything starts together, it's a lot better chance of returning together. Very old school, but very logical and very simple. You see so many great players making that waist high rehearsal. You know, and you mentioned Justin Thomas, but the guy that caught my eye first with this a while ago was a guy named Mike Weir, who made that rehearsal religiously. If you can get that whole mechanism started in kind of a dead heat, I think the ability to sequence the downswing becomes a lot easier.
Tom, just a couple more before I let you go, and I got to get your thoughts on the new Tiger Woods logo. We saw the clothesline came out. And Sunday Red. And Sunday is two words, by the way. It's Sunday Red. And it's going to be a standalone subsidiary of TaylorMade. I'm not sure why it needed to be Sunday. I saw the explanation of it. It really didn't make much sense to me because it just didn't. But your thoughts, what do you think of the logo and the new clothesline?
Well, a couple of corrections, maybe some help for you there. I guess he wanted to do Sunday as one word, Sunday Red, and somebody had it, because he was going to do SundayRed.com as a website, and somebody already had that web address, so he couldn't do that. So that's when he went to three words, Sunday Red. So that was the explanation I got on that. And then the logo itself, it was explained to me by, it looks like almost like a skeleton of a cat. Every one of those lines represents one of the majors he won. So the number of skeletal pieces matches the number of majors that Tiger won. So that's kind of, you know, kind of a cool thing. Although it looks kind of, it looks almost like a Neanderthal type cat. We dug up out of a kind of research rooms, but I don't know, Chris. I mean, does everybody buy into Tiger Woods' new apparel line in 2024? I mean, I know he still moves the needle. I know he's Tiger Woods. Does he still have enough juice to sell clothing and apparel? You know, and I guess the argument against me would be that Michael Jordan still sells sneakers. He sure does, right? So yep. We're going to see pretty quickly here. It's going to debut at the Genesis at Riviera. And there's going to be a lot of Tiger fans on property at Genesis. I'm sure they're going to just have that stuff hanging everywhere and every merchandise tent on the property. So I think by Monday of Genesis, we'll have a pretty idea about sales and how much it heated up. But, you know, I'm tired of betting against Tiger in anything because I always get my ass kicked by betting against him. So I'm not going to do that anymore.
So one more. I got to get your thoughts on the Super Bowl. What'd you think?
I thought that one muff punt off the back of a blocker's shoe that went sideways changed the whole momentum of the game. I thought both teams played exceptionally well. I think both teams are very well coached. I think both teams have incredible skill set players. And that little guy, Kermit the Frog from Kansas City, they call him Patrick Mahomes, did it again, didn't he? What a heartbreak when that punt came off that guy's foot, and that changed. I just think that changed the whole game right there. You know, it was one of the best Super Bowls we've seen in a long time, going to overtime and being close and kind of going back and forth. But you know, God bless Andy Reid, boy. He's cemented his place in football history, has he not?
Yes, he has. Tom, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can they stay up to date with you on your Instagram page, LinkedIn, all those different places, plus on your website?
Well, in show 93 on Next on the T, I think the best place to find me is right here every other Tuesday with the greatest host in the world, in golf podcast. So that's the first place you can find me, and the place that everybody should be tuned into every Tuesday night with your lineup and your talent, Chris, that should be right here. All the regular places, Instagram, you know, LinkedIn, Facebook, the website's just tompatry.com. But my real home has become every other Tuesday night with you, buddy, and I'm proud to be here.
Well, I'm proud to have you here. Can't thank you enough, my friend. You're the best. All the best to you and Mrs. Patry. We look forward to doing it again with you 2 weeks from tonight.
Just tell John Inman I said hi, would you?
I will absolutely do that.
Thanks, Tom.
Take care, TP. All the best.
Bye, buddy.
See you, man. That is the great Tom Patry, folks. Again, at Tom Patry Golf is where you can find him on Instagram. TomPatry.com is the website. And like I say, every time he's a part of the show, subscribe to that YouTube channel because you're going to get over 300 free playing lessons and tips right there for you that you can take out to the driving range or whatever it is you're going to practice. Plug those in and watch them and then execute what Tom tells you to do and you're going to instantly become a better player. I can't thank him enough for being here 93 times. But on top of being a great instructor, he is just one of the best people you'll meet on this planet. So like I say, we'll catch up with him again in a couple of weeks. Coming up next is a guy who had a stellar amateur career, highlighted by winning the 1984 National Championship and getting the Haskins Award for being the College Player of the Year. He would go on to win a couple of times out on the PGA Tour and then and becoming a great college coach, and that is John Inman. Before I get to John, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year, and I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I also want to give a shout-out to my friends over at On Point Golf and their great On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf, and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an On Point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use On Point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lampkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lampkin. Feel is everything. Now making his first appearance with me here on Next on the Tee is John Inman. Let me give you some background on John. He is from Greensboro, North Carolina, attended Grimsley High School and won the 1980 High School Athletic Association State Championship. Went on to play his college golf at the University of North Carolina, where he was a three-time All-American. In 1982, he won the ACC Championship. During his senior season, he received the Haskins Award, which is given annually to the College Player of the Year. He was the individual medalist at the 1984 National Championship. In fact, his 17-under-par score broke the scoring record that was set by Ben Crenshaw back in 1971. He also won the Western Amateur in 1984, beating Rocco Medi at 3-2. John turned pro in 1985, got through Q School in 86, and then got his first win out on the PGA Tour in 87 at the Provident Classic, which is just a little bit north of me here on 75 up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He won that tournament by a stroke over Bill Glasson and got Rocco Medi again. He won again in 1993 at the Buick Classic, this time in a five-way playoff that included a great friend of the show, Bob Estes. After his days on tour, he returned to the University of North Carolina and became the head golf coach there from 1998 to 2011. He led them to 16 tournament victories, two 10th place finishes in the NCAA National Championship. He also played a few seasons out on the Champions Tour and had three top 10 finishes out there. In 2012, he was inducted into the Guilford County Sports Hall of Fame. He is the younger brother of Joe Inman, who won four times between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tours. And I'm excited I get to have John with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, John, thanks for coming on the show.
Chris, thanks. Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you. And I got to tune in and listen to Mr. Patry. And hopefully I'll get to say hello to him. But that was a good segment. And really glad to be with you.
I appreciate you, John. And I want to go back to the early days with you when, as we start our conversation. And I read that Joe, who's 15 years older than you, really took care of you. Talk about growing up with Joe as your older brother.
Yeah, he was kind of more like a dad. You know, I was born 3 days before his 15th birthday. So, you know, I was always hanging around the range with him when I was a kid. The great Woody Durham, who was the voice of the Tar Heels, he was one of the sports announcers, or, you know, on TV at up in Greensboro. And when I was a kid, and he always used to say, you know, John, I've known you since you were in diapers, because I think I was still in diapers one time out on the range when Woody was out there like interviewing Joe. So, you know, I've always been always hung around. I was always, you know, trying to emulate what he did. You know, I learned my golf swing from him, just, you know, and the rest, you know, we're all different people, but I think we have a lot of similarities in our game. We're very, we have to be gritty because we weren't long hitters. We were the shortest hitters, and we had to, you know, figure it out. We had to figure out how to win. And, you know, my brother was an incredible, and to this day, 76 years old and still a great player. You don't want to play him at 6,000 yards. You put him on that 6,000 yard course down in Mexico, he'll shoot 60. I mean, he'll make 5, 6, 7 birdies. You know, you know, and I learned that a lot of that stuff from him, but I think I still have that, you know, some of those same tendencies. And, you know, it was great. He's always been a leading, you know, voice in my life, and, you know, don't always agree with him, but, you know, he taught me a lot.
Speaking of being young out there, I read that by the time you were 6, you were out there trying to play, and all Joe wanted you to do was chip and putt, because he said you can beat a lot of players if you can get up and down from anywhere around the greens consistently. Does that sound right about his philosophy?
That sounds exactly right, because, you know, and, you know, even when I went to college, you know, at UNC, you know, I was never a ball beater. It just didn't interest me. If I was hitting it well, you know, I would hit balls for 20 minutes. And if I was, you know, hitting the shots that I wanted, I would go chip and putt. But I could just spend hours around putting and chipping green. And that's what I did. And I knew that, you know, Joe really did make a point that was very important to success. And, you know, I love doing it. I love just spending time down there, whether anybody was there with me or not. I'd play my own games. And when I was coaching, I used to set up short game courses on our pitching green. And I have a 6 or 7 hole course that you had to shoot a certain score before you moved on to go hit ball. So we had to play the course, you know, it was an up and down course, and you had to shoot a certain score. And, you know, that I just, you know, that's what I tried to stress to, you know, my players. You know, I thought it was one of the most important things.
John, I also read that you play piano and sing. Is that just recreational for you and the family, or is it more than that?
Well, yeah, you know, I was way more interested in that than my brothers. All my sisters could sing, and I did play the piano. I took lessons for like 4 years, and but I was in, since 7th grade, I was in every Madrigals choir. I was in a barbershop quartet for, you know, since 9th grade. So, you know, we just got together, our barbershop quartet. We hadn't been together in probably 20 years or more. And, boy, we've lost something along the way. So we've decided that we need to pick it up, and we need to figure out how to get better at it again. But that, you know, that's what I did all through high school. And yeah, I was way more interested in that than my other two brothers.
Now, Joe played his college golf at Wake Forest. How did it come about that you go to a rival ACC school at North Carolina?
Wow. That was, you know, that was probably one of the most tumultuous parts of my life. You know, I grew up, my father was the project manager who built Wake Forest over in the late 50s and early 60s over in Winston-Salem. So that was one of the largest gifts to a university from the R.J. Reynolds Corporation. They gifted them that campus. And my father built Wake Forest. My brother went there. I went to all the football games when I was, you know, a kid growing up. And when it came time, you know, I was always, I told the UNC coach, I said, you know, we used to play the state high school right there at Finley Golf Course. And I told him, I said, you don't need to talk to me. I'm going to Wake Forest. And my sister Jeanette, in her infinite wisdom, she went to East Carolina, which is a little bit more of a party school than most. But she knew about North Carolina, and she said, "John, you need to go down there." So I ended up going down there one weekend and loved it. Not just liked it, loved it. And you know, to me, it was the place. It was the place for me. And I ended up signing a letter of intent that Sunday night. The coach came to the house. Dad wouldn't let him in. Matter of fact, my mom signed the letter of intent. My dad wanted no part. He never forgave me for going to Carolina.
Wow. Brutal.
Yep.
Don, in 82, you win the individual ACC championship. Then you led the team to the team championship the following year in 83-84, and it was played at Pinehurst. Talk about what you remember about winning the individual medalist honors and then teaming with Davis Love III and Jack Nicklaus II. To win the team title.
Wow. You know, I wish I remembered more. But I went through some bad stretches hitting the ball, you know, in college. Because I was, you know, and Tom Patry would be, he would remember that I used to be able, you know, very inside. And I'd hit drop kicks. You know, it was more of the move, you know, drive the legs, club drops underneath, and you flip the hand. So I went through some stretches where, I mean, I just hit it horrifically. I could always, you know, score because I just knew how to score. But, the year that I won, I beat, I think it was, Dillard Pruitt. You know, I was playing pretty good, wasn't playing, you know, great, but, you know, and then winning the team championship, you know, to me, that was always, you know, better, you know, I just really enjoyed, you know, Davis, Kurt Beck, Todd Thiel, Brian Sullivan, let's see who else, Greg Parker. I can just see, you know, Jackie, you know, it was, you know, both of those in 83 and 84 were very satisfying, you know, to win the team championship, to beat Wake Forest, you know, Billy Andre, and Jerry Haas, and, you know, a lot of great players, Mark Thaxton, you can go down the list, you know, but, we were all friends and, you know, golf's a small community. I looked, you know, tonight when I looked at the lineup and I was, and Barry Cheeseman, I'm staying on afterwards because I need to just heckle Barry Cheeseman. If wanted you to know that, you know, because, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, I hadn't seen Cheese in so long. And we were good friends out on the tour. And, but, it, you know, so it is, it's a small fraternity and, you know, to have success is, you know, is really special and it's much more special when the team does it.
With Jackie Nicklaus on the team and knowing how important it was to Jack to attend all of his kids' events, how often did you get to be around Jack?
Well, we used to go down there in the spring, like right before the season started, we'd go down and stay, like half of us would stay at Jack's house. And there was another couple that would host some other players. And we'd go down there and practice and play. And, you know, so it was always, you know, it was always intimidating. But it was really good. As a matter of fact, I want to tell a little story that I usually tell when I was giving speeches and stuff about how I learned, you know, what I wanted to do. And it was when I caddied in the 81 PGA for my brother Joe down at Atlanta Athletic Club. And I remember the first five holes, 456, 458, 470, par four, 220, 560, you know, I mean, just, he said, this is the greatest, the best grass farm I've ever seen, man. They can grow some grass down here. So, I ended up, you know, going through and Joe made the cut. I won't tell the Tom Weisskopf part, but, yeah, which was really instrumental, but the last day Joe ends up playing with Jack Nicklaus. And I was caddying. So I'm on the tee and we walk off the first tee the last day. And Jack looked at me. He said, John, how are your grades this year? And I almost choked. I mean, my grades were awful that year. And, you know, so I told him and he said, well, that makes me feel better about Jack. So well, we get to the 18th hole and, you know, you've got that lake and you got that walk around the lake. Well, Joe was playing with JC Snead and Jack Nicklaus. Well, JC and Joe stop before the lake to let Jack have his walk around the lake. Well, I didn't get the high sign. I was two steps behind Jack Nicklaus all the way around that lake. And a matter of fact, halfway around, I think he turned around and looked over his shoulder like, what are you doing? Well, I mean, there's 40,000 people, I mean, screaming for him. I mean, the hair on the back of my neck was standing up. So we get around the lake and Joe and JC were on the ground laughing. I mean, just laughing. So we get up there and when Joe comes up, he just looked at me and I said, I know what I want to do now. I want to do this. So that was pretty cool.
That is very cool. And speaking of things that are cool, I mean, you're the individual medalist again in 84. This time it's at the national championship. Team came in fourth behind Houston, who had a great team that year. Steve Elkington was a part of their team, but you go off and you win the national championship. What was that like?
Well, it's funny. The week before, yeah, the schedule was really weird back then. And, you know, we played the North-South the week before. And I got to the finals and I was playing a guy named Davis Love in the finals. So we're playing Pinehurst number two and he beats me 4-3. I'll make this story short. He beats me 4-3. But I mean, I got up and down. I think I was 12-12 from the bunkers. I mean, I did everything I could do. But after 18 holes, Joe said to me, he says, I'm glad you're playing him and not me. So we played well. And so then we fly out there, but Davis and I were on the same flight out there because I think the team might have, I think, already went. And so we fly out and, you know, I had played that course in the fall preview and I think I shot 12 over. So to shoot 17 under from 12 over, what's that? 29 shots? Right. Only got 29 shots better, you know? So it was kind of strange, but I knew I was playing well at the time. I hold three shots from off the greens from, you know, 30 to 40 yards for eagle on par fives. I mean, when I had a 30 or 40 yarder at that time in my life, I mean, literally, I thought I could make it. I mean, I it didn't really matter what was going on. I just felt like I could make it. I played really well. And Davis got two shots better every day. He shot 74, I think 72, 70, 68. And then we just, you know, down the line, we struggled. The guys just struggled a little bit. I mean, we had a real guy, we, you know, between Davis and I, we were 21 under and 6 under won the team. So, and we finished fourth. So, yeah, you can see, and, you know, and the guys just, you know, just didn't have that good a week. And we ended up finishing fourth, but it was a lot of fun. I didn't even realize how many under I was until like about the 17th hole, 16th hole, I was looking at the standard bearer walking with us. And I was just like, wow, you know, what are you doing? You know, but it's just, you know, it was one of those weeks. I mean, 1984, you know, runner up to Davis in the North South. I won the NCAA. I won the Western. I finished fourth at the Son of Hannah. I mean, I played really well that year. That was probably the best year of my life as far as a player in 1984.
So, yeah, you mentioned winning the Western Am. You beat my fellow Pittsburgh area native Rocco Mediate 3-2 in that event. And it's the Western Am. Hey, that's one of the top amateur golf tournaments we have in our game. So many of the game's greatest legend won that tournament. Jack won there. Tiger won there. Phil won there. Hal Sutton, Francis, we met. You name it. The greatest players in the history of our game won that event. So you go out there and you win it. What was it like for you edging Rocco that week?
Well, you know, it's funny. The last day, you know, we had talked, you know, Rocco and I, we knew each other, you know, all the guys in college, we all knew each other and played in the same tournaments. And we talked about it. We had team plus fours that we wore as a team outfit in 1984. And so did Rocco. Rocco had his with. We talked about it and we said, let's wear them in the final match. So both of us wore plus fours. So that was the funny. That was, to me, was pretty funny. But I mean, we have 10,000 people out there and, you know, following us. But I mean, to tell you how crazy it is, I mean, I had to tell my mom to send my one iron up there. I was playing a one iron, and you know, Barry Cheeseman will definitely laugh at that. I don't know what I did with it, but you know, I had it in my bag. I had to have it, and it was a great week. And again, I just, you know, I had such a good year that year. I just knew, you know, when I had a 15 footer to win or a match or something against Danny Miavich or whatever, I just knew I was going to make it, you know, and that's the, you know, most people, you know, never have that. And I was lucky to have it for a year, but you know, there's just time, you know, it was just one of those, you know, special things, you know, cause you know, golf, like my brother talks about, you know, at the end, you feel like Swiss cheese, you know, you just have like bullet holes in you, you know, just all the bad things that happen to you and that make you so fragile, you know, but there are times when you know it, you're going to make this putt, you're going to, you know, and that was my year.
You got Rocco again a few years later when you got your first win out on the PGA Tour at the Provident Classic up in Chattanooga, Council Fire Golf Club. You won it in style by, speaking of knowing you're going to make it, you sink an 18-foot birdie putt on the last green to beat both Rocco and Bill Glasson by a stroke. Talk about that win.
All I remember was I was walking on the other side of the fairway from Bill Glasson. That man scared me. He was a scary man. He was just intimidating. But the 18th hole, and I remember I had Rocco was in the group behind me. And I was on the fringe and I had a piece of grass on the back of my putter. And I'll never forget looking down going, should you get that off or whatever? I was like, yeah, come on, John, you've made so many of these, just hit it. And I hit it and I made it. And then Rocco hit it left of the green, chipped it down to about 4 feet and missed it. And then, you know, I win the tournament. So it was, you know, just very, very fortunate, you know, to be able to do that in my first year. And that gave me some breathing room and able to set my schedule a little bit more. And I lost my card a couple of times, but I went back and, I mean, one year I finished second at Q school and one time 17th or something, you know, so, you know, it's a grind for most people, not the, you know, the guys that you see, you know, on TV every day. That was, Rocco, has always brought out the best in me. And he is, I mean, just look at what he's done. He's had such a great career and great guy. And we're still good friends.
You get your second win out on tour in 93 at the Buick Southern Open, just a little south of me here in Atlanta, down at Callaway Gardens. Talk about surging near to the top of the leaderboard by shooting 64 in the third round and then winning in a five-way playoff.
Yeah, I was 125th. Going into the week, I was shot one over the first day. I was two over the second day after nine. And I had a little talking to myself. I said, you better, we could turn this around. And I shot three under on the back to shoot one under for the day and make the cut on the number. Wasn't expecting much, but I went out the third day and I just made everything. 16th hole, it was a par three. I remember I had five wood in there. You know, most guys hit six iron. I was hitting five wood and I had a 30 footer and I made it. And I looked at my caddy, said, just don't talk to me. Just leave me alone. I mean, I just was making everything. I mean, if it was 20 feet, 40 feet, whatever. And so it got me, I shot eight under the third round, got me in a good place. And I played with Bob Estes the last round and we kind of went back and forth and, you know, ended up in a playoff and I wasn't hitting it that solid. I remember I saw the replay of the 10th hole when I hit my second shot in the second hole of the playoff. We both birdied 18. And then I remember I was like 150 or 153 or something. And I had seven in my hand. I went back and hit six iron because I was hitting it thin. I just wasn't hitting it solid. So, and I hit it and I put my head down like, ugh, I knew it was right on line and it went up there 8 feet and I made the putt. I mean, I knew I was going to make the putt. So, yeah, it was, you know, and Bob Estes, what a great career, what a great player. And yeah, I'm sure, you know, just nobody likes losing to me because they're like, man, how can this guy beat? But that's the way me and Joe have been all our lives. I mean, you know, sometimes we get in there and win something.
John, just a couple more before I let you go. And speaking of Joe again, with the state of the game at the professional level and player distrust of Jay Monahan over the debacle of last summer and going behind the back and meeting with the guys from Piff and all that stuff, the person that I've heard some of your former peers mentioning, if there was going to be a new PGA Tour commissioner, who could it be? And I've heard a number of them say, Joe. Is that something you can see him doing?
Absolutely. I don't think he would, but I think in his day, there's no question Joe Inman would have been a great commissioner. Yeah, that's funny. Because I've said that many times and I'm sure some other people have, but you know, it's a tough deal. Look, we've all, you know, the tour is so multifaceted. So many, you know, there's like 26 different divisions or some number like that, you know, that, you know, some are for profit, some are not for profit. And, you know, it's a big wheel. And, you know, I'm sure it's not an easy job. Never was for Dean Beeman or Fincham, but to me it's a sad state kind of where we are in the game, but you know, it's going to work itself out. I have a, you know, golf's not going anywhere. People are still going to play golf, and there's, you know, it's still, you know, it's going to look different though.
In 2012, you were inducted into the Guilford County Sports Hall of Fame. What was it like for you being honored like that in your hometown?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. You know, if you make it into a Hall of Fame, it is really cool. And I'm very fortunate, you know, been a lot of great athletes come out of Guilford County. And, you know, I think of our quarterback that played at Carolina, Rod Elkins, who was just one of the best quarterbacks. He played at UNC. And, you know, it's really cool. You just have to think of, you know, how lucky you are to be recognized, you know, in anything, whatever sport it is. And there's, you know, I'm very happy to be in that. My brother was in that, you know, as well. So, again, I'm following in his footsteps.
John, before I let you go, let our listeners know, how can they stay up to date with all the things that you're doing, whether they're following you online or it's on social media?
You know what? I am a ghost. I played golf one time last year in the middle of the year until November, and then played two tournaments in a row and played great, you know, pro members kind of thing. And I was like, you know, that might be the way to go. I'm just not playing a lot of golf. I do not have a presence. If someone could follow me, they're doing really good because they're digging deep. So, you know, I need to play a little bit more, and I feel good. I've had back problems throughout my career, and, you know, I'd love to be able to get back out there and play some more. So yeah, like I said, if people could follow me, they're digging deep.
All right. Well, John, it has been a huge thrill having you as part of the show tonight. I know we're just kind of barely scratching the surface of the great things that you did over the course of your career. I hope we get the privilege of having you back on the show again soon.
Well, I appreciate it. And I'm pretty sure that we covered every great thing that I did. I'm pretty sure. So, anytime, Chris, would love to talk again. And, you know, just let me know.
I appreciate it. Joe, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
You got it. Take care.
That is John Inman. And folks, just a guy who had a tremendous amateur career, both in high school, college, and then translated that into playing really great golf out on the PGA Tour. And you heard how much fun he is. And I'm standing here looking at a John Inman Pro Set golf card, which kind of really got me thinking I'd really love to have him as part of the show. And I can't thank him enough for taking time out of his busy schedule to come back or come here and be a part of the show. And like I say, I know that he had a lot of other great golf tournaments along the way over the course of his pro career. So I hopefully get the opportunity to chat with him again soon. Coming up next is a guy who is the second rookie of the week to join me, a guy who was in the mix a bunch of times in the 80s and the 90s, won the 1986 Florida State Amateur, and is just a fantastic teacher of the game now, and that is Barry Cheeseman. Before I get to Barry, coming up next is a lady who has been named one of the 50 best golf fitness professionals by Golf Digest in our game, and that is Catherine Roberts. Catherine is an amazing lady. She's going to do a lot for us to help us use ground forces in our bodies to really get more strength and power in our games. Before I get to Catherine, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Jason Kokrak, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Use code NEXTONT20 to save 20% off your order at 2under.com. That's the number 2, UNDR.com. 2Under. Performance in your pants. Okay, now joining me is another guy making his Next on the Tee debut tonight and a former tour player as well, and that is Barry Cheeseman. Barry is from Galesburg, Illinois. Prior to qualifying for the PGA Tour, he played minor league baseball, was drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals back in 1977. He spent 4 years in the minor leagues as a catcher and a pitcher, also spent some time in the Angels and Yankees organizations. Turned his attention to golf in 1986. That year, he won the Florida State Amateur Championship by 2 strokes over Len Matisse at Innsbruck Resort and Golf Club. Earned his tour card in 1988 after going through Q School. He got his first win on what was then the Ben Hogan Tour at the 1990 Quail Hollow Open. Finished 13th that year on the money list and earned his tour card again. Went back and forth between the two tours over the next few years, then took some time off before coming back to the game in 1997. That year, he won the Nike Hershey Open, finished 6th on the money list. 1998 and 99 were his best years out on tour, finishing both years inside the top 100 on the money list. In 99, he had 3 top 10s. And over the course of his tour career, on top of those 2 wins, he had 26 top 10 finishes, 3 top 5s, and a 3rd place finish at the 1998 Michelob Championship at Kings Mill. Backed that up the following year in that same event with a 4th place finish. After his playing days on tour, he went back to baseball and was a scout for the Houston Astros for a couple of years. He's now a golf professional and a golf instructor down in Florida. He's got his own golf academy down there in Sarasota, Florida. And I couldn't be more excited to get to have him with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Barry, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Barry, I want to start our time by going back to your victory at the 1986 Florida State Amateur Championship. Like I said in your intro, you're trailing Len Matisse by 4 strokes going into the final round, and Len won the high school championship in 84. He won the Dixie Amateur that year, won the 85 Southern Amateur, and would go on later to finish 2nd in the Masters in 2003. But talk about chasing him down to win the 86 Florida State Am.
Well, I was a player that came out of nowhere that year. I was just an average Joe working for a living, and there were a lot of college players playing. I was lucky to qualify for it. Last hole, I actually made a double bogey and still won. The course was really difficult. I mean, I shot 2 over to win. I guess I was just kind of lucky because I wasn't playing with Lenny. Lenny was, I don't know, 2 or 3 groups behind me. So I was in the clubhouse just waiting for everybody to show up. So it was quite an exciting venture for me.
And Barry, you went through Q School a few times, and talking with several of your peers over the years, they talk about how that is the most pressure that they felt, regardless of anything out on the PGA Tour, the Champions Tour. Trying to get through Q School is the most pressure they felt in their careers. Was that true for you?
Oh, no doubt. I went, I think it was 17 or 18 times. I have had incredible highs and pretty much incredible lows. at tour school. I mean, the first time I went was 86. First try I ever made, I made it to the final. I really was, that was the year that I went, won the state am. I went and turned professional that year. Getting to the final was quite a venture. And then the next year I came back and got my tour card through the Q school. And going down to the last hole was extremely nerve-wracking. I mean, I shot 500 to make it. And so it was just trying to limp it in to get in just to get your tour card. And that was a pretty amazing feeling there.
In 88, you finished tied for 11th at the Greater Milwaukee Open, thanks to a final round 67. If Ken Green doesn't go out and shoot a course record 11 under 61 in the third round, might have been a heck of a finish in that golf tournament. As it was, he won by six. You were a few strokes behind that. Talk about being in the mix, because there were a heck of a lot of tour legends battling it out, trying to finish second, third, fourth in that golf tournament, and you were right there. What was that week like for you?
Well, for me, most of the, you know, I started out pretty good my rookie year. And then for a long stretch in the summer, which is later on in my career, summer was sort of my best season, I would call it. But, you know, coming in the summertime, I had not made any cuts. I had run on this stretch of bad luck. And then all of a sudden it clicked. And, you know, just kept going. The golf course fit me. It was more of a Midwest course, which is kind of the golf I grew up on. It just clicked and everything kind of happened. We played twosomes. It was the first week I had ever played a twosome. And I think it might even have been the first week the tour was trying to play the twosomes on the weekend. And all I did was we played fast and kept moving and just kind of got on a roll and kept going. So it was very exciting.
Barry, you get your first win at the 1990 Ben Hogan Quail Hollow Open. You won it by two strokes over Kim Young. What do you remember about getting your first tour victory?
Well, I remember how I finished it. I got up and down out of the bunker to make par. So that was pretty good to pretty pressure packed there. I actually came through when you needed to under the gun, and it was, you know, kind of clutch. So it kind of made me feel good. It kind of carried me on the rest of the year. I got close because back then that was the first year it was Ben Hogan tour, and the only amount of Q school cards they gave was five. So, you know, you were either in the top five or you were going back to tour school next year, but you were getting in a position where you could get to the final or the second stage. And so, you know, battling it out was pretty good. And Kim was a good player. He was one of those journeymen kind of like I was. And he played well, and I just, you know, got hot at the right time and played smart and made a good up and down at the end. So.
You get win number two at the 1997 Nike Hershey Open, which was a new tournament out on the Nike Tour that year. It was played at the East Course at Hershey Country Club. This time it's a one-stroke victory over Greg Lesher and Billy Downs. Both were great players. Take us inside win number two.
Well, you know, it seemed like every time I played well, I finished strong. If I remember right, I think I shot 67 there also to finish. Extremely difficult golf course. It was more U.S. Open type. Had to play smart. Didn't always hit driver, which I wasn't exactly known as hitting a driver straight. I could hit it really far. So, you know, played smart, played the par fives really well, which I guess sort of one of my strengths because of my length. And, you know, came in clutch. It got a little nerve wracking. And Billy was right behind me. I was in the next to last group. I think he had a putt on the last hole to tie me, and he missed it from, I think it was 5 or 6 feet. So I was sitting there watching that, which can even be more nerve-wracking than playing because you have to watch somebody else not do what they're trying to do. And so, but that was a really good adventure. I stayed with a family that week. that were members of the club, and they were out cheering me on. And you know, when you're staying with family, you usually keep in touch, and I've kept in touch with them all the way till now. So it was really cool. Hershey was a great golf course.
In 99, you had a share of the lead after 54 holes at the Tucson Open, along with Tommy Armour III. You ended up finishing tied for fifth that week in a field of 81 players who made the cut. Talk about being in the thick of it that week.
Well, that was actually a lot of fun. I had some from my baseball days. The White Sox were training out there, and I had some coaches out playing that I knew from Sarasota that were when they trained here, so I knew them. They were out watching. I had some family that I stayed with in Phoenix. They were watching. But just, you know, trying to go after it. It was a lot of fun that week. Unfortunately, I came up short. I was actually tied for the lead with three holes to go. And I made a finished bogey, which was not real good. But I had a chance actually on 18 to tie and ended up making I was trying to chip in from a short distance, and I ran it too far by and then missed the putt and ended up finishing fifth. So, but that was a really good tournament. That was cool.
You shoot 63 in the first round of the Byron Nelson Classic, and you end up tied for ninth that week. And Tiger's in the field, and it's Sergio, Steve Pate, Lauren Roberts, who would go on to win the golf tournament in a playoff over Pate. But you're right there in the thick of it with all of those guys and the early parts of their careers. What was it like for you to be in the mix?
Well, that was cool. I had a good friend of mine, and you may know who I'm talking about, J.C. Anderson, who was a former teammate of John Emmon. J.C. lived in Dallas, and he had asked me a few weeks prior to that if he could caddy for me. And I told him, oh, yeah, sure, you can caddy for me. And so I had never played good. In fact, I don't think I'd ever made the cut at the Byron Nelson. And just having J.C. on the bag, we talked about, you know, different strategies, and he kind of got in my head and actually made me play good. It was an awesome week. We had a lot of fun playing, you know, him caddying for me. So it kept me a little more relaxed. Played with Corey Pavin the last day, which was good because I'm a little longer than Corey. So Corey's about the length of John. So he was most of the time way back, but it was fun playing with Corey the last day. And that was a hard course for me, and I played way over my head. So that was cool.
Speaking of length, Barry, you ranked seventh on tour in driving distance that year. You averaged 287.1, and I'm sure if you had today's equipment, you would have been well over 300 yards. Do you remember the equipment that you were using back then at that time?
Yeah, I still have it.
Is that right?
But I still have it. I was one of the last guys that stayed with wood drivers before we switched over to metal. I was hitting it that far with that equipment is pretty good. I haven't hit a wooden driver or small headed, you know, metal wood for a long, long time. And, today I remember my last year was 2006, and that was on the Nationwide Tour. And I averaged over 300 yards, and that's all equipment based. I mean, I look back at my first year in 88, I think it was in the low 280s. And just the change of equipment. It was a wooden driver with a metal shaft, heavy as all get out, stiff as a board. And you know, equipment has just made leaps and bounds differences. In fact, I haven't lost distance until about 2 years ago, and now it's starting to go shorter. So it's equipment has changed the game dramatically.
Barry, let our listeners know what you're doing now.
Well, I teach golf now. I'm the director of instruction of Lombo Key Club, which is also a resort. on Lombok Key, which is just an island off of Sarasota. I've been teaching golf for about 12 years now. I remember some of my friends who had left the tour and went to teach. And I always said to them, I said, there's no way I could never teach. And then all of a sudden I did it. And I go like, wow, no wonder those guys did that. And I have a lot of fun. I enjoy doing it. I enjoy watching people get better. We are a big club. We have about 4,000 members. It's a 45-hole facility, a lot of seasonal people, but we do have a lot more year-round residents now. And it's a busy, it's a golf factory. We have a lot of people running around. I'm working pretty much 8 to 10 hour days this time of year because this is our season. And it's teaching golf is a great thing to do. I have a lot of fun doing it.
So, Barry, how can our listeners either follow you online, on social media, or come down and get a lesson from you?
Well, I have a Facebook page, Barry Cheeseman Golf Academy. I don't really get on it much because I'm so busy. I used it because I had a golf academy at another location where I needed some you know, social media help, and I have an Instagram page. I don't use those as much anymore. I even used to have a web page, but I discontinued that because I don't need it. But I can be reached at the Lombok Key Club. I can teach anybody. You can come stay at the resort. It's an incredible place. But it's, you know, it's a busy place and it's a great golf course. We're always in great condition. It's incredible.
Well, Barry, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to come and be a part of this show. You're fantastic, my friend. I've enjoyed hearing your stories, and I'm sure there's a whole bunch more of them. So I'd sure love to have you come back and join me again sometime.
That would be my pleasure.
Barry, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. Look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you.
Take care, Barry. That is Barry Cheeseman, C-H-E-E-S-M-A-N is the spelling of his last name. And just like John Inman before him, a guy who had a fantastic amateur career and translated that into success out on the PGA Tour. And again, a guy that won the Florida State Am. Look, when you look at the field that Barry competed against and the legends that are now out there on the PGA Tour, legends who he competed against as an amateur and early in the parts of his career are just astounding. The guys that he was up against every single week and having success against. So great job of out of him winning a couple of times out there and then translating that now into a guy who is a wonderful instructor. From everything I've read, people singing his praises about a great instructor that he is. So hopefully we get the opportunity to catch up with him and pick his brain a little bit more not too long from now. Coming up next is a guy I've been really looking forward to having as part of the show, and that is Robert Morris men's golf head coach Steve Shingledecker. Before I get to Steve, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com. Looking for the ultimate Myrtle Beach golf experience? Well, it's only a click away. Check out the two-play special at two of America's most awarded public golf courses, Caledonia Golf and Fish Club and True Blue Golf Club. They are low country masterpieces featuring two iconic Mike Strantz designs. Play these two incredible courses for one great price. Visit CaledoniaGolfAndFishClub.com to learn more about the two-play special and book your tee time today. Again, that's CaledoniaGolfAndFishClub.com. All right, now making it a trio of guys making their next On the Tee debut with me tonight is Steve Shingledecker. Steve is the men's golf coach up at Robert Morris University, just outside of Pittsburgh and Moon Township. He is a native of Franklin, Pennsylvania, which is just a little north of Pittsburgh. He's also been the director of golf operations and instruction at the Turn Club in Cranberry Township. Prior to that, he was the director of golf at Nemacolin Woodlands from 2018 to 2020, one of the world's top 100 golf resorts. In college, Steve was a four-year starter for the baseball team at North Carolina State from 1988 to 1991. He was the ACC tournament MVP in 1990, and his senior season, he was on the All-ACC team. After graduating with his degree in business management, he stayed at North Carolina State as an assistant coach, and he helped them win the ACC championship in 1992. Coming back to golf in 1998, he was a sectional qualifier for the U.S. Open. In 2001, he was a local qualifying medalist and sectional qualifier again, and he qualified that year for the U.S. Amateur. In 2003, he qualified for the U.S. Mid-Am. Unfortunately, Steve has shown a severe lack of judgment by hanging out with our good friend Eric Johnson since high school. And I was hesitant to have Steve on the show when I found that out, but I figured everybody's entitled to one bad mistake and a second chance. So I'm honored he is with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Steve, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me. And for the record, I was hesitant to come on to a show that would have Eric Johnson on. So.
Touche. That's fair. So Eric Johnson, I mean, he wanted to remind you. He wanted me to remind you of your title of being the second best athlete to ever come out of Oil Creek region. He said you were a garbage athlete, actually. Seems harsh, but I don't know. What are your thoughts?
That's kind of interesting. I mean, if you know, if you've seen Eric golf, you know he can do that. He can definitely teach, but that's where it ends for Eric. I don't think he can dribble, catch, throw, you know, any of the other things that would probably define an athlete. So, you know, he might make an argument on the golf side of it, but I struggle to listen to him use the term athlete when he refers to himself, but we'll let him have that for now.
He wanted me to ask you about the section championship that you lost to him.
Oh, for Pete's sake. For the record, it was his brother who takes credit for winning that, which ironically his brother's score didn't count initially. It was I think in high school you either took five out of the six, and after the five we were tied, and his brother was sixth, and his score ended up being the one that counted. So Brent actually takes credit for winning it, in spite of the fact he was actually last on his team that day.
On a more serious note, you guys work together a lot. I know you work together at Nemacolin, which is one of the top golf resorts in the country. Talk about your time together there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Eric and I, you know, we met when we were really young and, you know, kind of stayed in touch, but it's a different era. You know, when I went to play baseball and he went to play golf, it's completely different paths, and you're not going to text somebody. There's no social media. So, you know, it was more or less a thing where you just kind of keep track. And obviously after he went, you know, he went to the Breakers and for a while. And then when he came back to Oakmont is when we were able to reconnect. And for the most part, you know, I was doing, you know, more real life corporate America type things. And Eric was at Oakmont. So we'd see each other when we could. He had the boys. I had a family. I started helping out the boys a little bit with their baseball, and he would come down and help out at my club, and kind of one thing led to another. And when he was director of golf up there, or he was director of instruction, and they asked him to kind of take over the entire, you know, all the golf operations for the, if you know Eric, you know, he can barely open a computer, let alone use it. So, you know, he needed somebody with some business skills as well. So going back to, you know, all the way back, it was kind of the first time we had an opportunity to, you know, to actually work together. And I was, you know, I've been, you know, done a lot of things, but I played baseball, I coached basketball, you know, golf was something I always played and enjoyed and loved, but, you know, into the instructional side was very new to me. So, you know, having an opportunity to kind of climb in with, you know, one of the, please, I know you record it, just don't send it to him. One of the best instructors, you know, that, you know, is out there in the game, you know, was such a great leap for me, you know, to be able to learn from him and learn his techniques and learn what he was teaching. You know, and I've just kind of, you know, really taken that and, you know, ran with it the best I could.
So since turnabout is fair play, what's your favorite Eric Johnson story?
Oh, boy, that's a good one. He has, you know, there are so many stories for Eric. let's see, how many of them can we, you know, I think if nothing else, it was watching him. He could put on, you know, if you've seen his trick shows, incredible. There are times when, you know, Eric can hit it off of, you know, out of a bottle, off a balloon, off a tee, sideways, backwards, upside down, on his knees, backwards. And he would do those shows up there in front of the world and just hit and just impress everybody. And then when everybody would leave, I'd say, all right, now put one on a tee. Just a regular golf tee. And let me see you play that little drawback out there. And that's where it got a little more difficult for him. He had all the shots in the world except the one that you need nowadays.
That's great. So, Steve, let's go back in your career as we talk about you being a great baseball player. How does a guy who was a top ACC baseball guy end up becoming a great golfer and a men's golf coach?
Yeah, you know, I honestly, being a different era, I played baseball because that's what you did. You know, for the most part, I thought I was going to play golf in college. And my brother was a couple years older than me, was a phenomenal baseball player, highly recruited, and did go to NC State. And along the way, you know, the different coaches, different schools would come and watch him play and occasionally talk to me. So I knew, you know, I wasn't naive enough to not know that I didn't have some skill, but it was just kind of always going to be golf for me. And but you didn't, you know, back then you didn't just stop playing a sport. You played them all. You just, I would wake up in the morning, go to the golf course, golf as much as I could, and then get home and to put on the baseball uniform and play a game and do it again the next day. And as I got to kind of, you know, watching my brother's career start and grow and go down and visit and, you know, see the bond he had with his team, it became kind of apparent to me really late that I, you know, as much as I loved golf and realized there's a team component, you know, to me, I wasn't really ready to give up the true team sport. And so I decided at that point, you know, I was going to play baseball knowing that I could come back to golf when I finished up. And I kind of, you know, honestly, I knew I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to be a major league prospect or anything like that. I didn't have the size. I didn't have the, you know, I was kind of sort of the way I golf, kind of a grinder. You know, and my coach Tanner told me every year that he tried to replace me. And for the most part, every year I wouldn't let him. So I had a really, you know, I had just some wonderful memories playing at NC State. And I had some, you know, some really, really good days and, of course, some really tough days. But, you know, in the end, I was able to do what I want to do, which is get back into the game, you know, into golf, you know, eventually and play. And honestly, you know, evolving to where it is now, you know, where they say all roads lead to, I don't know that any roads led to this. I'm not even sure myself at this point, you know, how I ended up being a, you know, head golf coach at a university right now. It just one of those things that the dots really connected. And, you know, my love of the game and, you know, perfect timing has kind of put me in this position.
So you talk about having really good days, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but 1991, you bat 303, 5 home runs, 106 total bases, 49 RBIs in 68 games. You have 8 steals. You have 29 walks, 29 strikeouts. That's a pretty strong season for a guy who was just kind of going in there and they were trying to replace all the time.
Yeah, I can't believe I struck out 29 times, though. That's a lot. That was a lot back then. That was one of my pride areas, but nowadays you strike out 29 times in about 10 games. But I'll be the first one to tell you that a part of, you know, getting to go to be able to play in NC State was, you know, because I had a brother that was, you know, All-American. Coach Tanner, who was, you know, eventually went on to South Carolina and won a couple of College World Series and, you know, is now their athletic director. Again, he told me every year, like, I really would like to be able to replace you. But, you know, I was, you know, somebody who had to learn how to, you know, learn the intangibles, a little cliche, but, you know, I used the whole field. I could play any position. I think if I had a claim to fame, it would probably be that I started 10 or more games in 5 different positions as a left-hander. All the outfield, and we actually, you know, pitcher, and then we actually had a couple of first basemen. One, I think, was academic. One got hurt, and one day Coach Tanner threw me a first baseman's mitt and said, go over there. That's where you're playing today. And so I even got 10-plus starts at first base, which was I enjoyed. The rest of the infield didn't enjoy throwing it to a 5'10" on his tiptoes guy, but, you know, that's what I did. I did whatever that was that guy. I did whatever I had to do to make the team better and stay in the lineup.
You keep mentioning your brother, Gary, who had a wonderful career in college. Also got drafted by the Orioles, right? 11th round in 1989?
He did. Yep. He was, he had a really, really good college career and, you know, quite honestly, a pretty short professional career. And to his credit, I think it didn't take long again for him to realize, you know, back then there was such a big difference in, you know, number one, the aluminum bat to the wood bat. And there were, you know, a lot of Gary's success, you know, the balls that were home runs in college ended up going to the warning track in the pros, and the balls that got between third and short in college got ate up by the third baseman or shortstop. And he was more gifted than I was, but in the same boat. He was really, really good with just about everything, but he wasn't great, you know, and, you know, to play at that level, you have to do something exceptional, if not a couple of things exceptional. And it didn't take Gary too long to realize that, you know, there was a level that he didn't think he was capable of reaching.
Like I mentioned in your intro, when you come back to golf, you did it in 1998. You go through sectional qualifying for the U.S. Open. It was held at the Olympic Club in San Francisco that year. What was it like for you trying to get through sectional qualifying to make it into the U.S. Open field?
Yeah, you know, it's always been a little bit, again, untraditional for me. Growing up, you know, not having played college golf and, you know, coming out and just started jumping into, you know, if I'm being perfectly honest, the majority of my competitive golf where I live, you know, as you mentioned, about 60 miles north of Pittsburgh, most of my competitive golf involved the competition of the wallet in my back pocket. I didn't do as much of the, you know, the tri-state, West Penn State, you know, and so the qualifiers, the U.S. Open qualifier in particular was kind of one I had circled, you know, pretty early on and, you know, getting back into the game and, you know, took my lumps at times. And, you know, but, you know, when I always said, I think I'm a, you know, between the mid-am, I think I was a really good 18-hole qualifier, you know, because I could, you know, that was easier, like, I guess, with anybody else to kind of maintain. And, you know, and I remember the first time, you know, I was kind of in the hunt there. I know I was playing with John Mazza, and, you know, I'll say it on the show, I'll say it ever. One of the truest gentlemen that I've ever played around the golf with. You know, it's one thing to have somebody say to you, hey, good putt, good shot. You know, everybody says that. It's kind of another thing to feel that person is genuinely rooting for you while they're in the hunt too. And if I'm being honest, I'm not sure I was rooting for John. But you could tell that from him. And I you know, I got, it got down to the stretch, and, you know, I think I birdied 15, 16 and 17. And I can still remember, you know, having to think, and a simple 2-putt kind of gets me, I'm pretty sure I'm through. And it was about a 15 footer. And that was probably the toughest 2-putt I had in my short career playing golf. So, but I did get that thing up and down, and, you know, and away we went. You know, we don't have to talk about the next qualifiers. That was
as well, 2002 Mid-Am Championship. You finished second in stroke play to advance on to the match play portion of the tournament. It was played at Williamsport Country Club in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. That's another pretty strong week for you.
Yeah, it was. You know, I one of the things I, you know, again, being late to the game, one of the things I really enjoyed especially back then, was the mid amateur stuff. When I qualified for the U.S. mid am, for instance, that's when it was 30 and over. And so you got to go, you know, compete with guys like myself who, you know, weren't playing all day every day. You had other jobs, you had other interests, you had other things going on. I think the one thing that I remember about, you know, the state minimum was that I hadn't, you know, I had played, I've been playing, but I hadn't been playing a lot of tournaments. And when I went down, I didn't have anybody to go with. And I remember at the last minute asking my dad if he wanted to go down and caddy, and he did. And, you know, being able to shoot, I think, you know, 67, 68 in the first round and, you know, hang on to get towards the top of that, top of the stroke play part of it was pretty cool. That was, I think that was, my dad had coached me in everything and all the way along, but I don't think he'd ever actually carried my bag. And, you know, having him on the bag for that tournament was special.
You've talked about being well-rounded in your sports background. You also coached high school basketball. You coached Franklin High to a AAA state championship, and you were named PIAA Coach of the Year back in 2006. Talk about helping those kids and what it was like winning a championship in a third sport.
Yeah, that was really special. Kind of a combination of, you know, a town like Franklin is, you know, it's a small town. At the time, I'll say, though, you know, there were only four classifications in Pennsylvania. We were in AAA, so you played some pretty good competition. There's no, they don't distinguish between the schools that can, you know, bring outside talent. I'm trying to hold off from saying recruit, but I think that's the right word anyway. So being able to do it in a small town of kids that generally I saw grow up, and able to, and I honestly, you know, while I played high school basketball and was, you know, fairly good at it, you know, I got into high school basketball from baseball because I knew I couldn't play coach baseball and golf. We just don't have enough time up here to do them both. So I really loved coaching. I thought, what the heck, I'll coach basketball. And I started at ninth grade and, you know, kind of got a passion for, you know, the strategy of, you know, of coaching basketball. It's so different, of course, than, you know, baseball. There's a lot of downtime in basketball. You got to be thinking really on the go as a coach. And, you know, so I got, you know, really got involved there. And again, the kids that you coach there, they're the same kids that, you know, they played elementary together. They played, and, you know, in 2006, ironically, we were, you know, 2005, we had the same kids from six, but had some other, you know, five graduates that were really good. I think we were 28-1. We had a 22 or 23 game winning streak playing against the biggest schools. And we got bumped in the quarterfinals. And that was probably a better team. The next year, you know, it's just something you see in the NCAA tournament at times is that, you know, we had lost twice to a team we ended up beating in the playoffs. We didn't win our league. We didn't win the district. When we went into the state playoffs and it just was like that NCAA type of tournament, you know, I think we were a little bit higher than probably Valvano's Wolfpack or Villanova or something like that. But that's really what it was. It was a group of seniors catching lightning in a bottle and running with it. And, you know, it's funny because I've been able to over the years, I think this is I'll send them a text, I believe on March 24th, the anniversary of the game. And, you know, I've been able to go to a lot of their weddings and things. And there were seven seniors on that basketball team, and each of them are in every wedding party and every get together. And it's nice to, you know, because at the end of the day, as much as now we're dealing with NIL and all this, the live and all these globs of money that are being spent, it's nice to be able to realize and see that, you know, the kind of the true spirit of sports is your memories and your friendships and these kids who now have their own families and stuff, but they can celebrate and we can celebrate, you know, what they did for a really cool 2 weeks.
And Steve, now you're the head coach of the men's golf team there at Robert Morris. Talk about how you got the job there.
Yeah, that one is, that's probably the one that I say you know, there weren't a lot of roads that led to it. You know, 18 months, a little over 18 months ago, it was nowhere near my radar. And, you know, and truth is, I was working, you know, I was helping a couple of the kids on the team, you know, instructionally. And I knew that, you know, from talking to them, that the coach they had, Coach Stone, was, you know, having some health issues. And they had a volunteer assistant for a long time. And he had actually passed away. These kids had dealt with COVID. So kind of had a soft spot for everything they were going through. And I mentioned to one of the kids, I said, look, tell Coach, you know, if he's got stuff going on, he needs somebody to come by a practice just to be there, you know, I'd be happy to do it. And I got taken up on it. And then, you know, it just so happened that, you know, things were, you know, more serious for Coach and his travel was very restricted. So what I thought was going to be helping out at some practices ended up, you know, I'm on airplanes with these kids by myself and trying to figure out how to run a college golf program on the fly, you know, last year. And, you know, I got through the year. I went to every tournament, you know, multiple trips. And at the end of the year, when, you know, Coach Stone officially retired, it was, you know, I was fortunate. I developed a little bit of a relationship with a wonderful athletic director we have over there with great vision at Robert Morris, Chris King. We still went through, you know, the interview, the search process, the interview process, but it was a pretty natural transition since I was with the kids. So I officially took over in June.
And you've got a mixture of some young freshmen and fifth year seniors who are from all over the place that have come there to play at Robert Morris. Talk about your current roster.
Yeah, we, you know, again, it's a very, very unique situation. I would probably think it might be more unique than just about any program in the country right now, with being that I have there's only 8 kids right now on the team. I don't know what the magic number is. It's probably closer to 10, honestly, in college. Depends on your resources. But of the 8, you know, 5 are going to be gone after this year. There are 3 graduate seniors, another one who's in his fifth year but getting a regular degree, and another senior who, you know, just is going to get his degree and go into banking and finance. So there's five young men that are going to be there. Then I have, you know, 1 sophomore and 2 freshmen. And, you know, so recruiting has been, you know, obviously a key point for me. But the 5 young men that I have now that are graduating this year, you know, they're great kids. And I'm, you know, kind of been pressing as hard as I can to give them as much as I can, I guess, in, you know, what would be, you know, a really good final year. And, you know, if nothing else, a little bit more of a normal year again. These kids have dealt with COVID and, you know, some, you know, both of their coaches have some really serious health issues, and one, in fact, pass away. So, you know, we're working really hard, hopefully, to kind of have a last blast here in the spring and, you know, see what kind of run we can make.
You've actually got a tournament coming up at the end of March, the Cutter Creek Invitational. It's down in Snow Hill, North Carolina, not all that far from NC State. Might you get a little local support from the NC State fans?
Well, now that you mention that, we are actually, our spring break got a little bit mixed up too with, for the first time in, for I guess forever here, Robert Morris bumped the beginning of the semester up a week. So everything we had planned for the spring was now in, you know, in flux. So I reached out to some of the old friends, one being Robbie Paluski, if you're familiar with Robbie at Duke. And then, you know, I'm fortunate that when I was at NC State, a couple of the guys who were on the golf team that I became friends with are now head coaches. Bowen Sargent is at Virginia, Press McFall's at NC State. So I reached out to those guys. So we're actually going to Raleigh-Durham first. I think we're leaving March 9th, and we're going to spend the week, you know, 5 or 6 days at NC State and Duke at their facilities, kind of practicing. And then we'll return 10 days later to Cutter Creek and East Carolina. So that, and I do have some friends that, that I'll definitely see on, we're actually attending an NC State baseball game, whether they like it or not, we are, on March 12th. the original coach that recruited me as an assistant coach, Coach Ava, has been the head coach at NC State baseball now for a long, long time. And so we're going to be able to go to that. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Not to mention, the sponsor of the Cutter Creek Invitational is Bojangles. And I have not had Bojangles in a very, very long time. So I'm excited about that, too.
I bet you are. So, Steve, as a guy who's become a really good golf instructor, I imagine it's got to be a tenuous position for you, because when you get young recruits in or guys that have been playing, they have teachers, I'm guessing, outside the program. You're watching these guys play. Does it become kind of a touchy situation for what you're seeing from your players and what you feel like they need to do differently or better in their golf swings or in their practice routines versus when you've got a guy who's got an instructor outside of the team and that person has input? Does it get kind of sticky?
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. It does. It absolutely does. And, you know, it kind of starts obviously with your relationship with them. And I have, you know, a great relationship with all the kids, but at the same time, I walked into a situation where a lot of these kids were 4 years into playing college golf. And yes, many of them have their own instructor or instructors or guys they're seeing. You know, frankly, a lot of them are, you know, very comfortable. Some are comfortable in their own swing. And so early on, I decided and understood that, you know, being everybody's instructor is just not a rabbit hole you want to go down. We kind of have an open door policy. They understand that any questions, if they want me more or less to be their instructor, we can have that conversation. We do almost in every practice, they'll ask me to, you know, take a look at something. But, you know, I do not at all consider myself anybody's full instructor. I spent 2 hours with one of the players this afternoon on a track, man, just working on, you know, helping him hit a cut. But at the same time, you know, I don't really get into the weeds with them on that, you know, unless it becomes something. We'll talk maybe, you know, we'll certainly talk about the things I teach or, you know, we work on in practice are, you know, technique, core swing technique, and, you know, have some certain drills and competition because we're indoors and things like that. We'll be doing a lot of wet, different drills and stuff that'll help them. But it's crazy to think you can take, you know, up to 10, 12 kids and, you know, teach them all at the same time. And, you know, I think you'd also get into a little bit of, a conflict if you're spending more time with one. So you're absolutely correct. It's a, you know, we work on, you know, certain alignment and strategy on the golf course and, you know, definitely shots and things like that. But, you know, getting into the real deep dive of their, you know, their golf swing, I prefer to, you know, go, you know, I'll use Eric. I'll use, if they don't have an instructor or somebody along those lines, I've used Mike Labella up at Nemecol, and, you know, I'll send him video on the kids because I'd rather have another opinion in many cases.
You guys have 4 tournaments left in the season before you get to the Horizon League Championship. Talk about what you're looking for from the team as you get into these last 4 events.
Yeah, I think in terms of Division I college golf and in the mid major, you know, we have one of the things when I took over is I moved some tournaments, or I, you know, frankly didn't, you know, got out of some and got into some better ones so that we had a better idea of what was out there from a competition perspective. As much as it, you know, and we're on open and honest. I hand them a book I made a booklet about practicing, and I have our preseason projection of 7th in the league, you know, in the conference on the first page. I have our overall rank of 253rd on the second page. But with that said, we are 1.5 shots per kid per round away from being in the top 100. And, you know, when you break it down more into that, now you can start talking about, you know, some different strategies, some different, you know, it's like any other sport. There's always a couple of possessions that separate the winners and the, you know, the haves and have nots. And, you know, and I, what I saw a lot in our fall was, you know, there's, there are, you know, certain situations that we can improve on, and we're working on that. We're working on, you know, we're spending a ton of time, you know, indoors. You know, we were blessed to be outside 4 or 5 days last week, but a lot of it's indoors at the Dome, and we're working a ton on short game and on, you know, again, you know, understanding our lines and not crossing over and understanding that the misses are more important than, you know, the good ones. And so that we're not looking to make, you know, we're not looking to win the national championship, but if we can, you know, get 1% better every day, and we can eventually take 1 to 1.5 shots per round off of our score, then we can compete with any, just about anybody, you know, in the top 100. And if we can, you know, I have mature players, I have young players who are getting better, and, you know, if the next couple of months go the way we hope, then I think we'll give them everything we got at the conference.
So how can our listeners follow you and the team online and on social media?
Oh, I was afraid you'd ask that. I let the players kind of, you know, you can go to rmucolonials.com and, you know, go to the golf page, and through the golf page, you'll be able to get the links to the Instagram, Facebook. You can obviously see our schedule just on the website. You know, how we're doing, how we, you know, the results, the, you know, the old records and things like that. But yeah, I'd start it at the Athletics website and get into golf, and it should be able to take you everywhere from there.
Well, Steve, RMU is my mother's alma mater. I've got my RMU hoodie on as we speak. I'm rooting hard for you guys. You're fantastic.
I hope
we get the privilege of having you back on the show again sometime during the season, or hopefully shortly thereafter. I'd love to catch up with you again soon.
Absolutely. Anytime, Chris.
Steve, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. That is Steve Shingledecker. Again, what a tremendous athlete he is. You want to talk about a guy who's well-rounded. And we've talked on this show and to many players over the years about how important it is to be a well-rounded athlete and how that's going to make you better in any sport that you end up deciding to go to, as opposed to being the kid that just plays one sport and specializes in one sport. You become a great baseball player, a great basketball player, and that translates into being a really wonderful golfer. He did all of those things and now is bringing his talents not only as a basketball coach, won a championship there, won some ACC titles as a baseball player at NC State, and now doing great things at Robert Morris University. And on top of that, he just sounds like just a wonderful guy. And anyone who pokes fun at Eric Johnson is a friend of mine. So I look forward to actually, maybe we can get both of those guys on the show together. How much fun would that be? All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks again go out to Tom Patry, John Inman, Barry Cheeseman, and Steve Shingledecker for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are one of our great friends from over on our football show Thursday Night Tailgate, one of our guest Hall of Famers, is L.A. Rams legendary quarterback, and like I say, a great friend for many, many years, and that is Jim Everett. I can't tell you how excited I am to have Jimmy as part of the show next week. One of the top instructors in our game and a past Georgia Teacher of the Year, Kevin Roman, will be back, as will the founder of Caddy for a Cure and former PGA Tour caddy, Russ Holden. And then we'll round things out with someone who's become a wonderful friend over the last couple of years, and that is the wife of Billy Mayfair, Tammy Mayfair. She'll be here to share her stories from the years of working in the television industry at places like CBS Sports, where she was a part of their Masters coverage. So it's going to be a fantastic show next week, folks. I hope you'll come back and join us and be a part of it. A quick reminder that you can find this show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. In particular, we're out there on the Pittsburgh Tribune Review site. Just go to triblive.com, click on sports, and then podcasts, and you're going to find the show available front and center for you there. You can also find the show on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, and Player.fm. And again, as always, my thanks to the folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast from your favorite device right there on Good Pods. But most of all, my sincere thanks to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you all so very, very much. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.